I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them.
Chili, yeah? Cheese? Is that all for you?
And just read and what's in the line.
Indianapolis glass artisan Lisa Pilo has been creating magnificent pieces of glass for over 25 years, but that wasn't her intention. She grew up in Ohio, loving the arts, and went to Bowling Green State University. While there, she needed an extra elective to fill out her college credits, so she took a chance on glass and fell in love. Lisa stayed for 2 more years, earning a BFA specializing in glass. She spent 6 years heading the glass department at the Indianapolis Arts Center, where for 13 years she was a faculty instructor. These days, she is owner, operator, and instructor of her own studio called Hot Blown Glass. She's also an active member and leader of Glass Arts Indiana. It's an organization that hosts events to increase the knowledge and appreciation of glass arts. The group recently held a day of free hands-on classes at GRT Studios on the southeast side of Indianapolis. And that's where I met up with Lisa to learn more about her craft.
It's so intrinsically challenging. I mean, you have to figure out how the glass moves, what it wants to do, what you can ask it to do, but not really make it do unless you really understand temperature and motion and all that. And so you learn to create with the glass first, just process and safety, obviously. But then to like have an influence with art, your art flavor, you know, like how I like to express an art form with it, that's a whole nother stage. That's completely different. So, you know, then after you decide how you want to pursue the glass, like what forms you like, what techniques you like, and then you kind of add your colors, you add your forms, and you just expand on that.
Over here, drop low, drop lower, 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 turning all the time. There you go. Now we're going to go to your color.
My name is Tanya Rines. I'm from Indianapolis, and I'm here because my friend Patricia does her own glass blowing in her own studio, and she asked me to join her today at the event.
Have you made glass before then?
Nope, that was my first time.
What was it like?
It was pretty cool. It was hot, but it was really cool to watch it like take shape and become from like a blob of glass to something.
Clean up the form and then go back to the jacks.
But some people are super cool and they're listen and they can transfer the information we give them out, but other people are scared, frightened, intimidated. But I got to go with them because, you know what, they signed up. They paid me the fee, so I'm going to get them to the end, regardless of whether I have to remind them to breathe or not. And that happens a lot.
Nice. Your hand okay temperature-wise?
It's kind of hot, but yeah. I can't speak for everyone in the world. I knew that blowing glass took some time, but as I watched the demonstrations today, I could definitely see that it takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of time. You really have to dedicate towards it. And, yeah, it does take some strength. Some of it was, you know, you have to grip in a certain way, and you have to know how to shape different things. And so it was cool to learn.
You should feel like your whole shoulders are relaxed and like you're swaying in a boat. Keep going. I'm going to let you take over the rotation. Big, long turns. Good job. Watch this guy. He's doing pretty well. If this hand ends up gripping too tight, then this one can't turn.
We don't really have that many failures. We kind of anticipate where people will have a struggle because there's some tricky things. But if we can get them through, maybe on the second time, they're glad they stepped up, took on the challenge. Many people go, boom, off my bucket list. And they're really happy about that.
My name's Cindy Thompson, and I am the owner's wife. I don't actually work at the studio, but I teach classes here a couple times a month, just to use up some of the scrap glass. And this gives us the opportunity to have glass classes at a relatively inexpensive cost to the customers so they can have the experience of creating some art out of glass. We're making fused glass projects. We use bullseye glass. We have a substrate of clear glass, and then we create our little masterpiece on top of that using frit, using stringers, using vitrograph, and using all sorts of glass shards. The frit looks like sugar. So if you put sprinkles on a cupcake, that's what that looks like. The piece of glass starts out, let's say it's a 3x4 piece of glass, and then you add colored glass to that, to the top of it, and then we fuse that all together. People have been creating anything from plant steaks to modern art to beach scenes to characters, little dogs, cats, on glass, and then it's all fused together.
Can you tell me what your name is and what you're making?
Will, and I'm trying to make a sword.
Have you ever worked with glass before?
No.
What has this been like for you?
Kind of fun, I guess. So,
what are you going to do with your piece?
Just have it in my room, just sitting there on display.
Even take it a tad more to the right.
Gregory Thompson, I'm the GRT of GRT. It's the most universal medium out there. You can melt it, you can cut it, you can water jet it, you can blow it, you can fuse it, you can manipulate it. You can temper it, you can detemper it, you can cut it, you can make mistakes and start all over again. And at the end of the day, it's the funnest medium out there.
Open palm with your left hand, you're too grippy.
I'm Liz McComb. I'm a fused glass artist, and I'm a member of Glass Arts Indiana. All of the artwork for fused glass is done in a kiln. So it's heated. It can go as high as 1600 degrees. It just depends on what techniques you use in order to get a certain look. These pieces here, that is what they call a screen melt technique. So what I do is I lay glass on top of a stainless steel screen, and I heat it to 1600 degrees, and it melts through the screen, and then you get these particular looks.
Yeah, because it looks like a big dinner plate, but yeah. Multi-layered colors that have kind of, like, dripped into it.
Exactly, exactly. That's kind of the look, and then you can add more to it after that. Both of these pieces are three firings in the kiln, okay? And then this particular technique is what they call a pâte de verre, which is a glass paste. So it's used with what they call frit or crushed glass, and then a binding agent. And this is two times in the kiln, and then in between, you cold work it. It's what they call when you sand the piece and make it smooth, and then you fire polish it in the kiln so that it's smooth.
Looking at this, it looks like you made it pliable and you could shape it with your hands, but I'm guessing that's not how you did that.
No. The last firing in the kiln is what they call either slumping or draping. In this case, these pieces are draped. So a piece starts flat, and then you drape it over a stainless steel form, or it could be also ceramic form, so that the piece actually melts downward.
It's just great to be with a team of people that have just come alongside and said, hey, let's do this. And I'm like, okay, let's do this.
I'm Lucas Maxwell. I flame work borosilicate glass. It's different chemical makeup glass versus the soft glass. This is a lot more heat resistant and resistant to temperature change, so this stuff cool off a lot faster and heat up a lot faster without breaking. Gonna center it up, blow a little bit, make sure it's sealed. We use a torch, propane oxygen torch, to manipulate rod and tubing. The rod can be clear or colored. The same with the tube, it can be clear or colored, and it comes in all sorts of different sizes and wall thicknesses. So wide enough to stick my blow tube on. And so just heat those two, fuse those together. Flame working is a lot more independent, and that's what I like a lot about it. Where in the hot shop, you always need at least somebody else to help you.
And just keep up with the pace as it starts to curve and kind of dangle off to that left-hand corner. That's okay, because that's the start of our color application.
It's forever challenging. Incorporate something new and give it a new flair, a new little bit of excitement to pursue.
Pick up the pace as you see it starting to dangle a little more, and pause a couple seconds. More hiccupy on the rotation. See it starting to twist right off the end of the punny rod?
Yeah. Glass Arts Indiana offers information on events and classes on its Facebook page. Each year, National Public Radio's Tiny Desk Concert draws thousands of entries from musicians across the country. In 2019, one of those entries came from a rapper in LaPorte, Indiana, who's also a teacher. Curious Mix contributor Jennifer Weingart takes us into the classroom for a music lesson of sorts.
Joe Ruiz got sort of pushed back into creating music.
I had some students who kind of dug up some sound files that I had archived on SoundCloud. And one day, one of them came into my classroom and was like, "Hey, Mr. Ruiz." And he began to verbatim rap a song called Change that I had written in like 2005 or something.
And I'm an old man, white head, feet in the bed, ready to sleep. I make a documentary of memories that'll creep into my mind.
After college, Ruiz had gotten away from making music. He got married, had kids, and wasn't even thinking about it until the students dug up his old stuff and started asking,
"When are you going to make some new music?"
That led to a GoFundMe page, which led to a recorded song, which started selling. Half the profit went back into more music. The other half went as a donation to the food bank at Ruiz's church. The PAC Center is using that money to fund an outdoor community garden and food education space in downtown LaPorte. Ruiz ended up recording an entire album, and Rhymer Educator was born. At that point, Ruiz was working with pre-recorded beats and sound guy Mike Warner. Their pastor at State Street Community Church started playing the tracks as background during events, and the group gained two new members, Dave Ferris on keys and Chris Cribbs on drums.
You had overheard the music, and you said that, "Man, this is really cool." And then I explained that, well, it's that guy standing over there that did it. And you and CJ were already kind of working
right.
out music together,
yeah.
but didn't have like a really formed, solid idea of what you
no,
wanted
it was
to do.
Yeah, we just kind of jammed
so
around
I'm just
a little
like,
bit.
Well, let's go introduce you to Joe.
Right.
The group needed some low sound, so they advertised for a bass player on Facebook, and Chris Bendix saw it.
Yeah. Once I heard the music, I was like, "This could be really cool," you know.
They learned about the contest this year almost too late.
I just happened to see on Twitter maybe that they were accepting submissions for the contest. And this was like, what? The,
it was like a day before or something?
It was like two days.
We had like, yeah.
Yeah, 2 days before the deadline. And I was like, "Hey guys, we got to make one of these videos and submit it."
So they crammed into Ruiz's actual classroom around his desk and knocked out a video.
We like ripped apart my desk, took my computer off and everything, and like pulled the desk out and set up the drum set and instruments. And
lyrically, incidentally, saw beats, saw Dandy, she do a thing independently. And this is what it meant to me. Two tickets to a no-name show. Broke boy this week, but I got good taste, though.
It fit the Rhymer Educator label to do it in a classroom. So when the submission rules said that there needed to be a desk somewhere in the shot, and I just thought it'd be really cool to have like a real teacher's desk in the performance and the shot.
Ruiz and the band didn't expect to win the contest, but he says it's been a great opportunity to see other great musicians and have others see them.
I found myself just going through and watching all of the Tiny Desk entries. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I'm seeing all these talented people and I'm taking time out to just go through and watch all of their submissions. And artists tend to be people who just like art and like other music, and they're probably going through and listening the same way.
Ruiz says they're planning to enter again next year with more time to work on the video. For Curious Mix, I'm Jennifer Weingart in LaPorte.
Ahead on Curious Mix, Tripping Out.
And we'll hit I-40 in our old Green Accord. There'll be collateral damage, and we might get bored.
And Taming It Down.
We have flowers placed on different parts of the body to show where these women feel their hot flashes.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. How can a three-dimensional art exhibit educate women and men about the truths and myths of menopause? Curious Mix contributor Sandy Robe introduces us to the woman behind the Hot Flashes Cool project.
Newsflash, women get hot flashes. Although they are a natural part of aging, talking about them does not come naturally.
I'm Janet Carpenter, and I'm the Associate Dean for Research and a Distinguished Professor at Indiana University. Some women have very severe symptoms and that are almost debilitating for them and really need medical treatments for those. And other women have much milder symptoms and do fine on their own.
Carpenter is trying to educate the public about the phenomenon through a traveling exhibit called Hot Flashes? Cool. She and her colleagues are looking over the display in a room at the IU School of Nursing as they prepare to take the show on the road again.
We're going to be showing at the Women's Philanthropy event next week, and these are the new easels, Karen.
Beautiful. So, they really are nice.
The exhibit uses art to explain science. One display interprets the work of a medical anthropologist who traveled the world to research how various women experience hot flashes. Tell me what we're looking at and what this actually means.
So we have three dress form mannequins, and they're painted different skin tones. So we have an African-American woman, a woman with a golden skin tone representing Mexico, and then a woman from Bangladesh in a different skin tone. And we have flowers placed on different parts of the body to show where these women feel their hot flashes. So women in Mexico feel them on the back of the neck, women in Bangladesh feel them on the top of their head, and women in the USA and in Europe as well feel them mid-chest to the top of their head.
It shows that even though we're different culturally, we're really all the same because we're still dealing with the same symptoms, the same, you know, the hot flashes and what comes with them and what comes with menopause itself.
That's Tiffany Fox, who helps coordinate grants for the IU School of Nursing. She says the exhibit has helped her start a dialogue about menopause and seek more information, which are key goals of the exhibit.
I think it's empowering because seeing the data from it and the science from it, it helped me to talk with my husband.
This is the first time Mi Young Jung, assistant professor of nursing, has seen the exhibit.
And this is actually like bringing a lot of positivity on women's body and women's changes, because traditionally we think the menopause and the symptoms is kind of like secret and not a good symptoms and like getting old.
Another piece in the exhibit called The Herbals Industry depicts a factory hanging in midair with pills spilling into a trash can that is surrounded by money.
What we're trying to show is that the herbals are not grounded in evidence. So they're up in the air, right? They're not proven therapies. Either they haven't been studied or they have been studied and they are not shown to work. And so even though these products are marketed to women, they're not effective therapies. And women are literally wasting money on many of these treatments that are available.
Carpenter says it's important for women to understand the treatments that work and to stop using treatments that don't.
In our exhibit, we actually have both medications women can use as well as non-medication treatments. So things like clinical hypnosis, cognitive behavioral therapy, both of those are evidence-based treatments that have been proven scientifically to help reduce a woman's hot flashes.
So far, the exhibit has traveled the Midwest, West Coast, and Canada. It will keep making its rounds with continued funding. For Curious Mix, I'm Sandy Robe.
The definition of permaculture is the development of agricultural ecosystems intended to be sustainable and self-sufficient. Well, sounds achievable if you live in the country or on a farm, but what about the city? Curious Mix contributor Chris Siegel spent time with an Indianapolis family mastering the art of urban permaculture.
These ducks don't really like me pointing my microphone at them.
They're really cute, incredibly funny, because they're the runner ducks, the long ones, you know, like bottles. They also give us eggs, of course, very, very nice big duck eggs.
That's Adam Schwartz. He and his wife, Manu, own the Sunburst Homestead on the north side of Indianapolis. They take care of this flock of ducks, as well as gardens, chickens, sheep, perennial fruits and vegetables. All of the pieces they've cultivated at Sunburst are a part of a permaculture system.
One way of thinking about permaculture is that it's an ecosystems-based approach to designing an environment, a landscape, typically around human beings, but human beings as part of that environment.
The idea is that humans can live cooperatively with ecological systems, as long as they're aware of how those systems work.
So it's a lot about thinking about how things relate to other things. So by thing, it could be a chicken, a tree, a particular plant, the house as a structure.
So how do the ducks fit in that framework? Besides laying eggs...
They sort of wander around and they eat slugs and things like that and generally kind of help keep pests down. They also, as they wander around, they tend to poop, and that, again, is sort of tends to fertilize the property.
Adam and Manu walk me over to a bathtub in the middle of the yard, sitting just above a couple rows of plants.
When they go in there, they tend to defecate straight away. And so after a week or so, the water's pretty dirty.
Yep, the water is dark brown.
That water, which is now rich in nutrients, runs down and fertigates the vines that are there in those arches. And so when we empty the bathtub...
The water streams downhill, following hand-dug trenches. Eventually, it reaches the base of the plants.
We put these things together so that it works well for the natural elements as well, but also for ourselves. So we're getting something out of it. We're getting something to eat. We're getting something that gives us pleasure, whatever it might be.
Eating was a big part of what brought Adam and Manu to practicing permaculture in the first place. See, before moving to Indianapolis, they lived in Italy.
For me, it was much more the aspect of frustration with food. Obviously, we had good food in Italy, so we wanted kind of the same.
Manu tells me they've always tried to buy food that is fresh and nutritious, but they noticed that a lot of the food people eat in the United States is highly processed.
I don't want that for my kids, so the best thing was to learn how to grow it.
They walk me over to the garden. There, they show me strawberries, rhubarb, asparagus, as well as some rarer foods like...
Lovage there, which is a perennial type of celery, basically. There is walking onions, which are a perennial type of onion. They basically have bulbs at the top of their stalks, which then fall over and then they kind of propagate or walk that way. There's sorrel there. There's a type of citrus. It's still quite small, but a type of citrus tree, which is hardy in this climate.
Right next to the garden is a barn. We step inside and they show me their sheep, who are nervously watching us from a distance. Manu rakes up some of the bedding in the sheep stall. It's a mixture of old hay and sheep droppings.
Their manure and the straw, we kind of collect that and use that as mulch and fertilizer on the gardens.
They want to share their vision with people. They'd love to see permaculture more widely adopted.
Can we somehow bake in how they deal with the water in a more intelligent way? Can we bake in some more edible landscaping there? Landscaping with contour as well to sort of deal with runoff, to make what they plant more drought resistant? Can we reduce the amount of lawn that's a monoculture and is going to need pesticides?
But they want to reach beyond humanity. They also see the space as a kind of interspecies open invitation.
The birds come in of their own accord. I mean, that's their decision. The insects are going to hopefully come of their own accord. That's their decision. So having them come in and interact with what we've put in place is tremendously satisfying.
And the deer.
Well, yeah, the deer. I mean, that was, you know. Yeah, that's part of the, I guess, the dance. It's all a dance. You know, you try and design things so they work in a certain way, but it's give and take with nature.
For Curious Mix, I'm Chris Siegel.
Music videos have come a long way since MTV launched in August of 1981. Curious Mix contributor Kyle Long talks with an Indianapolis-based music video producer named Jake Huber about his work and his five favorite music video songs.
It strikes me that now more than ever, it's important for musicians to have like a really solid video to get their work noticed. People are experiencing music on their phone more and more now.
Yeah.
And that visual component is kind of important to document.
I think there's like two ways an artist can like really go down this path. And I think one is having a steady flow of video work, which means, you know, you might not have like a visual masterpiece per se, but you'll, if you have a 10 song album, you'll have 5 or 6 songs off the album with a simple run and gun video to accompany it. So you can release it once a month, once every 2 months. That's why, so you're always staying active.
You have 5 tracks picked out, the videos that you directed that you're going to share with us today.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's start going through these. What's the first piece you wanted to share?
Unless you like live under a rock, you got to know who Oreo Jones is. So I shot the track Nosebleeder for his new album, where he goes under the alias Michael Raintree. It's more like ambient experimental stuff. It was actually the first video I did with like a big team. A lot of these videos that I do that are like bigger budget have a whole team of people, and this is the first time we all linked up and made something beautiful together. It took about 3 days, no sleep basically, and a lot of hard work, but it paid off. So the next up, I think Flocko for the song Reverb. That's another one that I'm really proud of. It's basically, you know, Flocko is this super interesting personality. He's always like steady, consistent with his video work. He's pumping out videos left and right. He works with all sorts of videographers. He works with Tyler Hoyt, who's his like main guy, and he's super talented. He also like vlogs, he live streams video games, he's just a hilarious guy.
It's a very ambitious video with lots of parts and scenes, and good work.
Thank you.
Okay, bet these niggas can't rap like me. Bet these niggas can't dress like me. Folks upset cause they just up and lost it. And I had gonna get wet like me. Get that track then jet lightly. Kick that, I'm able to get shiggy. That's right, thought trying to hit my team.
What is your third pick for us, Jake?
I think Sirius Black... for his video Shogun, is basically him experiencing this like infinite loop kind of deal, where he gets shot, he kind of ends in this like minute clinic kind of nasty looking like waiting room, he gets operated on, and he gets kind of sent back out into the wild, gets shot again. Video.
Turn it up, ears bleeding through the speakers. Turn it up, pistol whipping fake prophets teaching evil. Looking at my wrist as I'm walking through the dead of night. Good and evil staring at me, so I let them fight. It could buy a crane at your liquor spot. Losing track of time, Sunday also ticking clocks. You missed the spot, you missed the spot.
And Jake, your fourth pick for us?
Fourth pick, I think, will be Draco McCoy. He has a song called Mudblood. He... pretty much on his last album, this I think this song kind of had like a different sound than his like typical like, you know, hype stuff. So I kind of want to make something that was more story driven for him. So we decided to do this kind of like creepy wedding. It's like the bride and groom are super weird, and he's infamous for doing sprite showers or sprite baptisms, where he'll bring someone on stage and he'll pour a bottle of sprite on them. And it became like a huge thing on Twitter, and you know, people, when they think of Draco, they think of, you know, the sprite showers. So I wanted to showcase that. So the groom offers the bride a bottle of sprite that's like in this really like decked out box with cushion inside it and stuff instead of a ring.
Yeah, and what's your fifth pick for us, Jake?
I'm going to say definitely my favorite video I've done, which is Euphoria by Baby Ebony. And basically it showcases Baby Ebony kind of fighting his demons while under the influence, driving around Indianapolis, which leads to him crashing his car and getting dragged out by a police officer. And we reveal that, you know, he's driven outside the city. And, you know, Baby Ebony has been somebody that my buddy Alex Falker and I have been shooting for a long time live. He acted in a video I did for Sunny Paradise. And we were like, man, this guy has the looks, he has good style, and he makes great music. And so after that shoot with Sonny, he gave us his EP for Don't Rush Death, and we ended up doing two videos for two songs on that.
15 years old, popping pills that ain't prescribed. Hard being black in this world, trying to survive. Mom's getting beat. All I could do is cry. Power pistons are just angry all of the time. Nothing left to do but take the hell along to school. Find a way to cope, pop pills to get me through. I ain't this shit because I thought it was cool. It was either that or Graddick Ash. Whoa.
Well, your work is extraordinary. I appreciate you taking time to come here and talk about some of the excellent videos you've made. Thank you so much, Jake. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
How does a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
This book in my hands is called Poems of the American South. The poem I'm reading is called Trip Hop by Jeffrey Brock. Trip Hop. I'll pack my toothbrush and my cyanide molar, the iPhone, the car seats, and the tactical stroller. I'll pack a snack bag with the craft food groups and white flags for me and black for my troops. I'll pack a fresh pack of Shark's double-edged blades, my boy's razor scooter, and my girl's blue shades. I'll pack doses of patience and some Kevlar smiles, check our air and our fluids, our gauges and dials, and we'll hit I-40 in our old green Accord. There'll be collateral damage, and we might get bored. But we won't need TomTom to know where we're headed, a theme park they dream of, a theme park I've dreaded. And if we ever get home, and if our home still stands, I'll unpack my dark heart and Purell my hands. I thought of this poem because our daughter is now 21, and I somehow survived her whole childhood and never had to go to Kings Island.
Oh, my heavens.
Or Santa Claus, Indiana.
Wow,
my wife did the Santa Claus one and the Kings Island. We took her to Walt Disney World, but...
So you never had to pack your patience in
your Purell. Somehow I lucked out. You know, I would have done it. I would have walked across that hot black top and just perspiring and yeah, whatever. I mean, I'm sure it'll be interesting, but I survived that and somehow lucked out. And I just the whole book called The Poems of the American South, and it just has a ton of great poetry about the South, about Elvis, about bootleggers, about you name it. And I highly recommend it, Poems of the American South.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back again next week with another poem to make your journey more enjoyable. Still to come on Curious Mix, a top 10 talent.
I was excited, glad, proud.
And a savory superstar.
Pork broth that simmer in like red curry served over vermicelli noodles.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. It's time to perk up our palate with a little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who know the tastiest places in town, especially when it comes to ethnic eats. If you want to try some true and tasty dishes from Laos, head to Pho Real.
The restaurant is called Pho Real, and my name is Ep Ely, the owner. We actually specialize in Southeast Asian cuisine, primarily three countries, Laos, Thai, and Vietnamese. The house specials are dishes from the country of Laos, which is between Vietnam and Thailand, and some of our most popular, like in the summertime, would be the Nam Khao, the Kabun, which is a pork broth that simmer in like red curry served over vermicelli noodles. That's very popular, as well as the Lao chicken noodle soup, which is called the Khao Phiak, which loosely translates to wet
rice, and it's just the thicker rice noodle that's simmered with lemongrass, some ginger, chicken breasts. We use fish sauce as part of our staple in Southeast Asian cuisine, and then the spice level, which is we do 5 levels, no spice, mild, medium, hot, Thai hot, which the customer chooses. We garnish it with cilantro, onions, some fried garlic, shallots, and some black pepper to top it off, and it's good to go. It's whole and fresh, you know, a lot of fresh products and veggies, and it's good, you know, and a lot of people don't know very much about it here, actually, in Indianapolis, even though it's getting pretty diverse, so we felt that it was a good opportunity to introduce some people to that, and it's, you know, people are loving it and liking it a lot.
Pho Real is located at 9611 North College in Indianapolis. A national campaign started by a sixth grader in 2015 called #1000BlackGirlBooks has in turn led to an Indianapolis fourth grader making her own national impact. Curious Mix contributor Bob Williams has the wrap-up.
Indy has a great music vibe. It's thriving and jiving and so alive. The talent stretches near and far, but it's east where we have our new hip-hop star. Coast to coast, 1,000 entered, a competition that was education-centered, a Black History rap, hosted by Flocabulary, caught the eye of a teacher in a Warren Township elementary. One of his students, Tyranny's her name, made the top 10, bringing her fame. Smarts and gift will take her far. As a fourth grader, she is a superstar. Even though she's only 10 years old, she had a story that had to be told about Marley Dias, who wrote a book about Black girls being overlooked. She started a movement that will never fade, even though then she was in the sixth grade.
Wrote a book. She's very inspiring. Open up and take a look and just read in between the lines. And when you do, you will find how she
I talked to Tyranny Moncrief, her teacher Dustin Eckert, and her father Terrence Moncrief in her classroom in Warren Township's Grassy Creek Elementary School.
It inspires me to be what I want to be. She truly is a hero.
How do you start writing a rap song about somebody? Where do you begin?
I organize it in chronological order, from when she was born, what made her do that, and then what was the effect from when she did that. So then I would organize it, and then at the end of each line, I would like find something that I could put a rhyme to, but it made sense. And then I would do my next line, and when I used vocabulary, it would pop up a list of rhymes. So I would use those rhymes, pick one out that'll make sense, and then I put that in. Then I would practice those two lines, and I do it with all the rest of the information. And then when I get done doing all of this, I rehearse it all, and then I keep practicing, and then I decide, like I revise it, and I decide what could be fixed.
You wrote the rap song. How did it get produced into a video that you submitted, or did you submit it as an audio project first?
First, what he did was recorded the audio, and then...
And who's he?
Skip.
Skip. He's a local artist. He's a local rapper. And he actually went to Warren Central when he was in high school, and he lives right around the corner. And so I connected with him, and he performs around Indianapolis, and... has an album coming out this summer, and so he does a lot of mixing and recording and producing as well. And so he agreed to help the kids out get theirs recorded into a final product, both audio and video.
There are 1,000 people who submitted entries, and you're one of the few who was recognized for excellence. How do you feel about that?
I was excited, glad, proud.
Mr. Moncrief, were you surprised? Did you see this coming?
I didn't see it coming, and in all honesty, I wasn't surprised. However, I was amazed, you know, to see, this is one of my four daughters, so to see her excelling, you know, it does a great deal to me as a father, So it's definitely one of those proud dad moments, you know.
Does artistry run in your family?
Absolutely. My father is a musician. So my father is a guitar. He's a lead guitarist, and he's also he can sing as well. Myself, I never picked up a single instrument. I probably can't hold a tune if you put it in my hand, but you give me a pencil or some paint and an ink pen, and I can do something amazing with that. So definitely, like I say, it's amazing to see, you know, that talent handed down from generation to generation, you know, and hopefully they don't take it for granted.
Mr. Becker, did this surprise you at all when you got word that she had finished so high in this competition?
Honestly, not really, no. I knew what she had written was pretty solid. Actually, we had several kids in our classroom that submitted some really outstanding raps, and they all did a great job recording them. So I felt pretty confident we're going to have somebody make the final eight, and I just wasn't sure who it was going to be. But Tierney had put together quite a rap, and she's pretty confident with it, and her delivery was pretty outstanding. So not really surprised at all. She's a pretty gifted kid.
Have you heard from Miss Dias?
Yeah.
She reached out to you?
And what did she have to say to you?
She was like that the rap was amazing, and she had retweeted it, and Mr. Record reached out to her, and I got a signed book. Yeah.
And now you are, she was an inspiration for you, and now you are an inspiration for others. You think that carries a lot of responsibility on your shoulders?
Yeah.
2017, she won the Fourth grade. Indy's future is looking pretty good, isn't it? For Curious Mix, this is Bob Williams.
It's hard not to see a mural on a building in downtown Indianapolis these days, but in 1973, it was a very new idea. One of the city's first, called the Urban Wall, is in danger of becoming an urban legend. Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez introduces us to the artist who created it and the man trying to save it.
I believe in the power of art and architecture to make our lives better and more interesting. And I would love to see that mural in particular brought back to life.
The mural in question has no title, but it's commonly called the Urban Wall, after the early 1970s program that commissioned its creation.
Mayor Luger had a vision, and I do think it's really interesting that, as far as I know, that this was the beginning of utilizing the arts as a means of bringing interest and prosperity to downtown.
Painted in 1973, the Urban Wall has presided over downtown development for over 45 years. Many Indianapolis residents drive or walk past it, visible on Delaware Street, just across from the City County Building. It can be seen from Luger Plaza, a public space named for the late former senator and Indianapolis mayor who dedicated the mural's completion. It wasn't alone.
There's also another mural on Washington Street called the Runners. It's even bigger. And then there's a mural that wraps around the Minton Capehart building. And then at one point there was actually an eight-story mural on a building in Mass Avenue. The whole building was painted white and it had a corn cob on it and it said Hoosier. It was a kind of movement that cities were doing in the early 1970s to bring buildings back to life, because in this time people were leaving the city in droves, cities were having trouble with finances, they were doing anything they could to get people interested in downtown. And so this mural was doing a number of very specific things.
Richard McCoy has become an expert on the Urban Wall. He's an Indianapolis resident, but also the director of Landmark Columbus, an organization that looks after the design heritage of Columbus, Indiana. He's used to being a good steward of history and fervently believes in the power of art being used to energize cities. He's got one other thing going for him.
I would say a friend of... Roland, can I say that I'm your friend?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's a friend of Roland Hobart, the 90-year-old Austrian-born artist, now living in Bloomington, Indiana, that designed the Urban Wall back in 1973. He's worn many hats since, but at the time worked in Super Graphics, a large-scale design concept used to alter a space.
Anything abstract is naturalistic, which does not exist.
Over the years, Hobart has refused to assign or explain a meaning to his design.
There's a lot of truth in the reason behind his not answering that question, because as soon as you define why that mural is interesting, it loses some of its power. And so I think what's compelling to me about that mural is it does have a kind of poetry, which in poetry at its best moves beyond words. It's a kind of thing that reminds us the power that art has in telling us things without ever giving us a thesis or a purpose.
Untitled is still the best. Yeah, it's my fantasy. That's nothing. If you put the title on it, then people look for it. Look for specifics.
Originally covering two buildings framing a small parking lot, only the side facing the city-county building remains. Water damage forced the repainting of the other building. In the 1970s, the wall had a vibrant contrast of oranges and reds sweeping into curves along with blues and blacks. Today, the blues have bleached almost white, and some of the red and orange curves remain, forming an almost S. Hobart has given some clues as to the symbolism of the shapes. They center around the concepts of harmony and disharmony.
Harmony is anything like this, when the inside is the same way, both sides here, yeah. But it's reciprocal.
Hobart ran his fingers along the curve of the S part of the mural on a printed booklet from the 1970s.
And disharmony is, for example, anything you put out away from the basic design.
Hobart pointed to the angled arrow-like elements on the lost side of the mural.
And here, for example, here.
More curves.
And then a little more disharmony here. A lot of disharmony there.
It seems like most of the disharmonious parts of the mural were on the second building and are now lost to time. The remaining half, mostly harmonious, has chipped away, the concrete showing through. McCoy aims to change that.
I think that Roland Hobart's mural in downtown Indianapolis should be restored, because I think if it were, it would be the single most important public artwork in the city. We've forgotten how amazing it could be to have it there.
McCoy is working to raise nearly $250,000 to fund the restoration. He's been raising awareness about the mural, making people stop and look up as they pass by. It should not be overlooked, he says, or taken for granted. As for the restoration process, enter Brian McCutcheon of Ignition Arts, the same company that brought the city the white indie sculptures, where viewers become the eye, specializes in historical restoration and reproduction of large artwork.
As an artist and a business owner in Indianapolis, I think it's important that we maintain these artifacts in the city, especially when they're of such great quality. Artwork enhances our society. Being that it's across the street from our city center, yeah, I think that that's reason enough.
In deference to history, to what was, Hobart hopes that some of the texture of age will remain through the restoration. He likes what the elements have done for his design over the decades.
Yeah, so sometimes even better because of the texture. After it was aged a little, like in the very beginning, it was very, very sterile. As the time went on, then you got more texture. Looked a bit better.
Brian McCutcheon welcomed the input.
It made sense to me to hear that having some more texture to the mural would be sort of an ideal condition for the restoration of it. I'd be curious if we get the opportunity to go ahead and restore the mural to figure out if there is a means of maintaining some of that texture, or if maybe the building condition, the history of the building, and the cleanup of the building before we actually apply the new paintwork might even already be a part of that fabric.
To help with fundraising, McCoy is looking to reissue a poster, similar to the 1970s initiative, showing the untitled urban wall design in all its glory.
And so we're looking to make this relationship with Cathead Press to see if we can make this poster again. Maybe not to raise all the money that's needed, but to remind people how cool this could look.
It's a lot of money and going to be a lot of work, but McCoy is in it for the duration. It's his mission, to do right by Roland Hobart, his friend.
It's my community service, and I want to see it get done, and I'll continue to work on it. And I really think 2019 is going to be a big year for the project, and we're going to make a big push to get that mural restored.
For Curious Mix, I'm Joy Hernandez.
Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this curious mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Kyle Long,
Joy Hernandez,
Matt Pelser,
Bob Williams,
Sandy Robe,
Chris Siegel,
Ariana Beatty,
Jennifer Weingart,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.